Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. I don't think we have to work too hard to promote the program tonight or slip a few hints about what's to come as kind of teasers. If you're a regular listener to Coast, you know what's coming. No guest has generated as much interest and anticipation as David Politis does. He first unveiled his missing 411 project with me on Coast some years ago. If you've heard any of those previous interviews, you know it's a gripping subject, baffling, perplexing, and more than a bit spooky. And you know that Dave always does his homework. He's been gracious enough to unveil each new book of the series on the nights when I've hosted, and these are the kind of shows where nobody goes to sleep early. Most people don't go to sleep at all after hearing these stories about mysterious disappearances. The focus, of course, as we know, started in national parks, then expanded to national forests, then expanded further, often concentrated in clusters, specific clusters. The cases discussed in the books are carefully screened to meet certain criteria, and the facts and circumstances which would rule out obvious explanations. People getting just lost or killed by predators, dying of natural causes out there in the wilderness. Tonight, the latest chapter. And instead of casting sort of a wide possible net, Dave has narrowed his focus to a specific set of victims, if you will. People who share common characteristics. Tonight, the focus is on hunters. And I think that's especially chilling, given that hunters are often our best and most experienced outdoorsmen or outdoors people. People who know the woods, they know the mountains best. They're the most comfortable out there. They're better equipped than, say, a day hiker or even a casual camper out for a weekend with the family. They're not only well equipped, they're armed. So whatever is preying on them, whatever is killing them, whatever is taking them away to wherever is apparently not deterred by guns and bullets or bows and arrows or knives. I think by the end of tonight, we might have a better idea of what's going on, what Dave Politis thinks of it himself, which, as you know, he's always been careful to avoid committing to any particular answer. I think for a long time, it's because he wasn't really sure what that answer is. But now you know what's coming tonight. The new book is called Missing 411 Hunters, Unexplained Disappearances, and it's chock full of new cases. Almost 150 of them, covering four different countries. And I'm telling you, they're flat out weird. Dave will be with us for 3 hours tonight, and I promise I'll carve out some time so you can ask a few questions. And then in hour four, still trying to work this out, his son Ben directed the documentary film. You might recall some of you listeners probably were involved in the crowdsource funding of that project. I got a look at it a couple of weeks ago. It's chilling and fantastic, and Ben is the guy who directed it. I'm trying to line it up so maybe he can join us in hour four tonight and talk about the film a little bit. I do hope that you will take the time to visit the Coast to Coast website, where you can find links to Dave Politis' work on tonight's page. Also there, Knapp's News. It's the eclectic little collection of oddities and items accumulated by webmaster Lex and I, culled from various news and information sources. Among the stories tonight, something that fits the mood. A story about death and other mysteries at a spooky lake in New York. Also a story about how scientists are bringing people back from the dead. Some amazing medical work being done. A TV piece that I put together this past week about NASA's underwater laboratory. You ever heard of this place? It's Aquarius, it's called. Off the coast of Key Largo, underwater. They got teams of astronauts, or maybe we call them aquanauts, under the Atlantic Ocean, learning skills that will help them eventually in space. Also, a physician who was along on the mission this last 8 days or so, we got to interview him working on some technology that's right out of Star Trek. And also a story about DNA tests that show Maybe there is an unknown species of human out there, something we were unaware of previously. That'll get the juices flowing. Those stories and more in Knapp's News on the Coast website. While you're there, check out how to become a Coast Insider. Cost about 15 cents a day, giving you access to a vast archive of programs, the current stuff, classic stuff. And you can check out George Norrie's TV show, Beyond Belief, also available by prescription. So let's get ready to rumble, folks. The dog and the cat should already be inside the house where it's safe because, you know, we don't know what's lurking outside there. Maybe slide the deadbolt for tonight. Put on a pot of coffee or maybe a nip of something stronger. This might even be a popcorn night. Slip into those silky jammies, plop down into that easy chair, turn down the lights and turn up the radio because here we go. Dave Politis, Missing 411 Hunters, coming up. I'm George Knapp and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. You know, hardly a day goes by when I don't get emails or messages about the missing 411 subject. People have their own theories, their own explanations or incidents they want to ask about or questions about the methodology that is used, all kinds of stuff. Dave Politis is gracious enough to keep me in the loop between projects, between visits here to the program. In addition to the new book about hunters vanishing, there's a film project that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that many of you may have contributed to. We've talked about it a few times here. It's an interesting point. And Ben Politis is the guy who directed it, and he'll be joining us in hour four to talk about where things stand. Dave Politis, as many of you know, has a 20-year background in law enforcement and technology. His new book is the sixth in this series, and each one seems to creep us out more than the previous one. Welcome back to the program, Dave.
Hey, thanks a lot, George.
Let's talk a little bit about hunters in general. I mentioned in the first segment about sort of your narrow casting a bit in your earlier works. You cast a very wide net, gathering cases that sort of fit the criteria. Now in this book, you kind of focus down on a specific population, and it's almost creepier than the other stuff because of the skills that these particular folks have. Or am I overstating it?
No, I think that's a dead on. When in the earlier books, we talked about kids that were walking the trail with their parents and disappeared. And, you know, your mind can logically say, well, you know, they're small kids. They're walking with their parents. They weren't paying attention. Maybe they walked off. And sometimes people walking alone on the trail, they'll go out alone a lot. They maybe get lost and they're off the trail. But deer hunters, bear hunters, those people are attuned to being in the woods. They know exactly where they're going to go out and hunt. They know the terrain. They know the dangers. They carry weapons with them that are there to preclude them from being injured by other mammals. A lot of times they carry walkie-talkies with them so they can talk with their partners. Many times they'll carry a GPS trail guide and maps to ensure that they're going to the right spot. A lot of these guys that I've written about and women have gone to the same spot for decades to hunt. So they know that area like you know your backyard.
It's really like saying if it can happen to them, it can happen to anyone.
In many of the instances in this book, you read it, and I kept reading more and more details about it because it just became more and more confusing about how it could even happen. And I think that if you shoved one of these cases in front of the public, they'd say, oh, it's pretty obvious this person was murdered and, you know, it's a crime and it's obvious homicide, but there's just no suspects. But when you look at tens of them or dozens of them, you start to say, wow, how can this even be?
Let's talk for a second before we jump into the cases about the kind of emails that you get. You must get them. I get them here and there, and it's not even my books. People who want to give you the explanation or people who want to give you information. I'll bet you get search and rescue people who are either they get ticked off because maybe they think you're slighting their work or maybe they want to give you off the record information. Talk about that for a second.
So let's start with search and rescue people. First of all, they are the life's blood of search and rescue. 90 to 95% of all the people searching in the woods are volunteers. They're people that have gone out on their own time with their own money to get certified to search. You know, it's not sheriff's deputies and rangers 90, 95% of the time that are searching. They're volunteers. They're just people from the community that are going out and doing it. And they do a fantastic job. And one of my books I dedicated to them. I've spoken in front of their groups before. They are great, great people. But they're searching and they're looking to rescue somebody. They aren't thinking criminal intent. They aren't thinking something unusual is happening. They just want to find you, make sure you're okay, and get you back to safety. So those people are absolutely the best, and without them, we'd be a lost. 90% of the people would never be found because there's not enough professional people in law enforcement to go out there and look. Now, as far as the emails, this is kind of a frustrating part because there's people out there that'll listen to a couple of our interviews, maybe watch a few YouTubes, and they'll write to me and they'll say, oh, I know what's doing this. And I get the same sort of email hundreds of times over a six-month period from different
mountain people. Lions.
No, it's mountain lions. It's, you know, I've heard just lately it's people growing marijuana. But people don't think about it and say, well, if there was a marijuana grow up going on out there, the last thing those people want to do is to bring any awareness to that area and bring searchers in because they'd find the marijuana grow. And in none of the cases I've ever written about has there been a marijuana grow found and people suspected in that grow of doing anything. It just doesn't happen. But I get a lot of them that people say, oh, you know, I know what it is. It's one of the multitude of unusual paranormal things out there, and I get this. But what they forget is what we talk about on your show are maybe the top 5 or 10% of the cases in the book. And we don't go into detail into the graphs and the tables that I've written. And by now, there's over 2,000 pages of documents. There's probably close to, you know, 1,800 cases. There's a geographical cluster map with 59 geographical clusters of missing people in North America. All of this leads to a very perplexing situation. And I say this on Facebook and on the other social sites. I have yet to find anybody that has read all of the books that has a cogent idea about what is happening. Now, the people that just listen to the interviews, they, a lot of people I get this from. But when you look and you lay out all of the facts from the different scenarios that all have linkage to one another, there's not one thing that really fits into that mold.
Let's do, just in case there are people there who have not heard the previous programs or haven't read the book, or it's been a while since they've been exposed to the material, maybe go over some of the profile points, the system that you use to sort of weed out explainable cases, because you do. I mean, the kind of criteria that you use, it's a very specific set of stuff that sort of weeds out a lot of what would normally happen out in the wilderness or the woods, right?
Exactly. And this didn't come about quickly. I mean, I didn't read 10, 15 cases and all of a sudden develop this list. It was after reading hundreds and hundreds of cases that you all of a sudden start to realize that the same things keep showing up. So part of that vetting process is that, number one, if somebody showed mental history of suicide, mental illness, etc., they usually got vetted out. If there was any signs of an animal attack, animal predation, that got vetted out. So right away, if search and rescue or if professional trackers came in and said, oh, this person was dragged away and there was a crime scene there with hair and blood everywhere, well, that case got sent to the side. So the primary points that came out at the beginning and still hold true is when they bring canines to the scene to track the victim, the canines either can't find a scent or refuse to search. And that's a fine line because you really don't know what they're doing. Sometimes they walk in a circle and lay down. Sometimes they go up the trail 10 feet and sit down. Professional trackers brought to the scene can't find tracks and track the victim from point to point. A lot of times, if the victim is found, their body is found in an area that had been previously searched. Now, what I mean by that is sometimes that area where they're found has been searched 20 times. In a couple of instances, the victim was found laying across a trail the search and rescue people went out and searched every day on. Now, I'll say this again so it's really clear. This is not an indictment of the search and rescue people. They do a great job. This is something unusual that's happening. And over the years, many of those search and rescue people have contacted me by email or through social media and said, hey, we know exactly what you're talking about. And it's happened to us many times, but the people running it don't want us to talk about it, and they don't want to say anything about it, but it happens a lot. Another profile point, the weather changes during the disappearance or soon after. What I mean by that is that a lot of times you'll read in these reports that at the point the person went missing, bad weather moved in, it started to rain, it started to snow, it started to get windy, fog moved in, all the above, something like that happened.
Effectively covers the tracks a little bit.
Yeah, right. And there's the geographical clustering of the cases, and that this came out after about, I don't know, 800 or 900 cases. Being from police work, I would often, if we were working a serial robber, rapist, or something, put a city map up on the wall, and we'd start to put pins in where the person hit last. And early on in this, I thought, you know, just for me to keep track of where all these cases are, I'll put a map up there of the U.S., I'm going to start doing this. And all of a sudden, these clusters of disappearances start coming out. Right now, there's 59, with the largest cluster of people missing fitting our profile of Yosemite National Park. The other part of this is that a lot of times clothing or shoes are removed off the victim. A lot of times, I would say 90 to 95% of the time, the victims disappear in the late afternoon or early evening. Many of the victims either say to friends or associates that they don't feel well, or they have some type of disability that's later told to the searchers by the family. Now, I've said this on all your shows. I'll try to get through it real quickly. Originally, looking at national parks, reason being is it's a specific area, and the national parks have a national park police. Police are really good. They're trained well. They're at 211 locations across the U.S. So you know that they're going to keep track of the stats. We filed the Freedom of Information Act request against the National Park Service for a list of missing people. Got a call from one of their attorneys asking me why I wanted the information. I said just for research. They said that they don't keep track of missing people. And I defied you to go into any medium-sized police department in the U.S. and ask their police chief for a list of missing people. And that person couldn't have a list on their desk within 30 minutes. Park Service says they don't keep a list. So I said, okay, I'd like to get a list. And they said, for Yosemite, that'll be $34,000. For the entire system, $1.4
million. Jeez.
Needless to say, that was shocking.
It's maybe the most amazing thing to me because, as you know, I after we had talked about some cases here in Nevada, I made some inquiries and got the same answer. So it's not something that you're making up. I mean, that's what they said. We don't have a list. You know, this point about the victims having an illness or disability, a lot of times it's the very young. And as I saw in the new book, The Hunters, these guys are experienced woodsmen, but a lot of them are elderly people. So it's like the young, the old, the sick, the infirm. It's almost like a culling of the herd kind of a process from one perspective.
It almost seems that way. And the other part I've talked about before is, sometimes these victims, and I note this in this latest book several times, the victims tell a friend or tell someone right before the disappearance that they don't feel well. And that's occurred in other disappearances in other books before. And you got to understand that these search and rescue people and the hunters that are friends with these people in the woods, these searches aren't periphery, quick, and done. These are massive searches. And it makes no sense that they don't find these people. And you come back, say, a month later, well, at that point, the body's getting pretty ripe, and you bring in cadaver dogs that can smell a dead body for miles. And the idea that they don't find any body, firearms, backpack, nothing, that doesn't make any sense.
I mean, we'll get into this later, but it's like they're taken somewhere else, and then some of them get brought back.
Oh, that's been brought up to me more than once. Yes, for sure.
You've, in the hunting cases, we'll get into maybe the over, we're going to take a break here in a second, but you've broken it down by the states with the most disappearances of hunters. which I think is kind of chilling. I was surprised by this. I had two states in mind that I thought would be at the top of the list, and they're not. So when we come back, we'll get into that list, and then we'll go down into some of the anomalies involved in the cases, specific cases that you have analyzed, starting with one, a guy from my home state here, a guy up in Reno who went on a hunting trip up north. We're talking with David Politis about his new book, Missing 411 Hunters, Unexplained Disappearances. In a moment, we dive into the new cases. Stick around. I had read that the characters in this song, The Wait by the band, are based on real people that were known to the members of the band, the guys who put that song together. It's a great classic. We're talking with David Politis about his new book, Missing 411 Hunters. And some of the cases we're about to get into will chill you to the bone. I mean, the hunters, experienced outdoorsmen and outdoors women. They're not all men. Most of them are, but some of them are women. They know their way around. They hunt in the same areas year after year, many of them. They are least likely to get in trouble out in the woods. They are armed. They know how to protect themselves. They know how to survive in the wilderness. But something snatches them up, takes them somewhere else. A lot of them don't come back. We're going to get into those cases in just a moment, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Dave Politis, if I had to guess before I read the book, which state had the most cases of the 148 or so that you deal with in the book, I would have guessed California, only because it's such a massive population. You got, I don't know if they've got millions of hunters, but I know hunting, it's a very active hunting state, either that or Alaska, but that's not how it breaks down. Share that with us.
So in order of disappearances, Idaho had the most with 18, Montana 13, Washington 11, Maine and Oregon were tied at 9, and Colorado had 8. And what's interesting about that stat is that Idaho also has a lot of people that weren't hunters, hikers and such, that have disappeared and never were found. Now, the most disappearances by year, 1950 had 8, 1948 had 5. And then by month, November, they had 62, October 46. That's kind of understandable because that's predominantly when hunting season's going hard. Kind of strange is that February is the one month out of the 12 where there were no disappearances. And then other anomalies on the list, there were 8 women that were listed in the book that I wrote about. And unbelievably, 2 of the 8 disappeared within 3 days of each other in 1950. One was in Vermont and one was in Montana, and I thought that was really strange. And then 3 hunters disappeared in different instances within 7 days of each other in Michigan. And I wrote a lengthy part of this in the book, and this was in 1909. Between November 9th and November 16th, 3 vanished and were never found in far northern Michigan. It was really, really a strange set of instances there. And then 2 age groups with the most disappearances, 22 years old and 65 years old. 22 had 7 and 65 years old had 6. So again, we're talking about those opposite ends of the spectrum. And then there's more anomalies on the list, but those are the big ones.
I mean, as you note, most of them overwhelmingly are men. I guess it probably corresponds to the fact that more men are hunters.
Well, I think so. I think that would be logical. In some of the instances that I wrote about, a wife went with them. They went into a hunting camp, and while they were there camping, something happened, and either a child that was with them disappeared or the wife disappeared. But it was in that hunting environment where everyone was armed, and all of a sudden someone's gone, and nobody could explain how, even though there's probably hunters all over that mountain, and the people weren't found.
Let's jump into some specific cases. This guy from Reno who ends up going to Alaska, his name is Anthony Granada.
Yeah, and this case, when I first read about it, there were several unusual aspects to it, but Anthony was an accountant in Reno for a big accounting firm. Husband, father, loved the outdoors, which was one reason why he lived in Reno. Well, he drove from there to Seattle in early August 1966, and then from Seattle, he flew into Alaska. His intention was to make hunting trips out of a city called McCarthy, into the Wrangell Mountains, and he was hunting for doll sheep and goats very high up in altitude above timberline. Well, McCarthy, it's located about 30 miles west of the Canadian border and 225 miles east of Anchorage, essentially in the middle of nowhere. And he heard about this area from several friends that the hunting was just phenomenal. And he liked to go in alone, and he did go into the mountains alone, and he shot a trophy sheep and goat in almost 3 days. And he put those on his backpack, and he was so loaded down that he made a decision to leave his rifle and other supplies on the mountain, hike out with the sheep head and the goat's head, and drop those off, then go back into the mountains to get the rest of his supplies and the rest of the meat. Well, he made friends with the caretaker of the Kennecott Copper Mine in McCarthy, and that was the predominant business at the time. Well, he told him that he was going to go back into the mountains, get his supplies, and return no later than August 18th. Well, when he didn't return, the caretaker called the Alaska State Troopers. Word eventually got back to Reno and his wife and kids that he was missing. Well, Anthony had a 22-year-old brother named Archie, and he was kind of who was picked by the family to go up into McCarthy and look for his brother because the wife had young kids and couldn't go. Well, Archie was a young college student. He arrived in early September, and they took him to the room where his brother had kept most of his belongings, and he found a roll of film that hadn't been developed, and he had it flown to Seattle for developing, a pretty smart thing to do. Well, within a few days, that came back, and Archie searched the room looking for facts. He couldn't come up with much. But the pictures came back, and they showed his brother with a giant doll sheep that he had killed in the mountains. He showed the picture to locals, and they recognized the area as the Nizina Glacier, N-I-Z-I-N-A, or the McCarthy Glacier, and different articles had it named by different ways. But by now, the Civil Air Patrol, Alaska National Guard, Army helicopters, and Elmendorf Air Force Base had all committed to fly sorties into the area looking for him. Well, all of them claimed that fog inhibited their search efforts on many of these sorties because they couldn't see the ground. Well, Archie found a guide, and he left with the guide to go into the glacier. And en route there, they found one campsite that they could confirm it was Anthony's, and they confirmed that because they found a small matchbook with a Reno business on it. Well, after they left that campsite, they got into an area that was rocky, bouldery, and just essentially barren because they were above tree level. And they thought that they had found the exact area where Anthony had taken the picture with his doll sheep based on landmarks they had seen. And they searched that area for 3 days. They found nothing. In total, the military flew 48 missions, saw nothing, found nothing. An Air Force rescue team took over the search in the short term. They found nothing. And on September 24th, 1966, the Nevada State Journal had a headline saying, "Tony walked into what has proven to be a mystery void." Now, the parts to this, he was never found, by the way. Neither was any of his equipment or his gun, nothing. Doll sheep stay really high up in the mountains above tree level. There's very little cover, so flying an air mission over that, everything will stick out. And flying from the air, you can see things for miles in that environment. And to never find his backpack, the rest of the sheep, his rifle, his other supplies, eerie.
You've talked about boulders, rocky terrain, barren rocky stuff, granite. What is the significance of that? Is there a suggestion that some sort of a predator or something is hunting, using that as camouflage or background, or is attracted to that kind of terrain? Or what do you think the significance of that is?
Well, I was recently in Australia, and I did three talks there, and I made a presentation to them about people that were missing from their country. And the three areas that I highlighted all had giant mounds of boulders, granite. The number one place probably in the world for granite is Yosemite National Park, and that just so happens to be the number one place in the world for disappearances. And I've had a lot of people tell me that there's certain things in granite that are unusual, that can throw things off and There's a lot of stories that go with that, not a lot of facts, but you can't ignore it. It's just the truth.
The other thing you mentioned in this case about Anthony is the fog that shows up that inhibits the ability to search. And there are a lot of those kinds of things that pop up. What you're suggesting is this weather sort of comes out of nowhere. I mean, you know, we're talking about the woods and the wilderness. There's going to be bad weather, but in at least some of these cases, it's striking how quickly it comes in out of nowhere. And it almost seems designed to stop any kind of a search or picking up any scent or tracks or anything like that.
Well, and in a lot of these cases, I think the hunters are absolutely flabbergasted about the situation they get themselves into, because one of the safety things I talk about at the back of the book is, hey, before you go into the woods, one of the last things you ought to be doing is checking the weather. And, you know, obviously in the mountains, weather changes a lot and things can go from bad to worse really quick, but you should be checking that weather before you go out and commit yourself to 2 or 3 days in the woods. But in many of these instances, just like in this case here, I don't think the hunters or the search people predicted what they were faced with.
Meaning it wasn't in the forecast necessarily.
Well, I don't think that these guys in the Air Force would be flying these sorties knowing that there was fog in that area. And they usually have some pretty good weather forecasts from their meteorologists.
I guess, you know, the unspoken question there is, how do you manipulate the weather? Let's say there's some intelligence involved in this, in these abductions or this predatory practice. The idea that somebody could control weather on a regional basis, that's a pretty nifty skill to have.
What's funny about that is I've gotten probably over 10 emails from people in the last 5 years talking about weather manipulation, and supposedly our government and other governments have that ability to do it. Even at the minimal level, we can seed clouds and make it rain. But there's often, in many of these emails I've received, saying that the government can manipulate the weather much more than we are known to believe. Now, I don't know if it's true or not. I'm just telling you what it's been sent.
In all these cases of hunters, they have weapons of some kind, guns. Are there any of these cases, and I don't want to jump sort of too far ahead, but is there any case where anybody, it looks like they used their gun to fight back before they were taken away?
There was one case where a guy disappeared. They searched for him for months, and they found him, and his gun was broken in two. And they set out this theory, and I go into it in the book at length, that he fought off a bear to the point where he hit the bear with his gun and broke it in half. And, I mean, the story that whoever this person came up with, it was pretty outlandish.
Wow.
And the guy ended up being found deceased under a log with severe injuries, and it didn't make a lot of sense. I mean, I kind of took it apart bit by bit, but there aren't a lot of those stories where you can think that there was a fight to life. And if, you know, there are those stories out there, but they're easily understood to be maybe it's bear predation, or maybe the person got gored by a moose or an elk or something, and that's what killed them. But not a lot of these head-to-head battles.
You mentioned in the book that bow hunters, I didn't know there were that many. I know it exists, but I didn't know there were that many, but that they are targeted maybe even more than people with firearms. There's one case, Aaron Hedges.
And the bow hunter stories are the strangest stories in the books. I can honestly say that for some reason, either they're not found or they're found under conditions that are just totally bizarre. Aaron's case is one of the most bizarre. And a super experienced hunter, and this isn't a joke, he was hunting in the Crazy Mountains, that's the name of them, in Montana. And the location was, he was about 20 miles north of Billings. He was with three friends, and they took the Cottonwood Lake trailhead into the Crazies. And all three in the group were carrying radios to communicate. So somehow during the day, this has happened about September 7th of 2014, he got separated somehow. And this is another element that I talk about in the books is somehow, and it's unexplained how, and nobody really knows how, but they get separated. The group gets separated. Well, he gets on the radio, and he says that he missed the trail back to their camp, and he was going to go on to a place called Sunlight Lake. And he knew this location really well because there was a cache of supplies there from the previous year that he had placed, the sleeping bag, food, etc. He was going to grab some of those supplies and meet him back to camp that night. Well, the following morning, he still hadn't made it back to camp, but his friends knew he was super well adjusted to the outdoors. They didn't worry. He figured he was just going to spend the night there, hunt for some elk, and meet him the next day. And he had the supplies, and he was armed with his bow, and he knew the area super well. Well, the pair of friends that day killed an elk. They brought it back to their camp, and when Aaron didn't arrive that Monday night, the friends started to become concerned. And the friends that night stayed in position. The next morning they wake up and they start looking for Aaron. Well, that night they didn't find him and they got real concerned and they left and they started to look for assistance. So on Wednesday they made it out of the mountains. They called Aaron's wife, reported him as missing, and they called the sheriff. Now the press did state that the delay in reporting could have played a part in the search. Well, the men were hunting on the western side of the Crazies in Park County. This is important because the Crazies cover several different counties. So they were on the western side. On the eastern side of the mountains is Sweetgrass County. Well, the initial report stated that Aaron was lost on the western side of the mountains and Park County took control of the search. And by the time Park County started the search, snow had started to fall. And there was soon 2 feet of snow on the ground as the search party started to go into the field. So there was a 3-day delay in getting Aaron reported missing, and then a 2-day delay in getting people into the field to search. Now, 5 days of inclement weather, chances are you're probably dead, unless you're super well situated in the mountains and have the clothing and perseverance to survive. Well, the Park County Sheriff soon realized that Aaron could possibly have been on the border with Sweetgrass County, so he called for their assistance. Well, there's a September 28th article in the Livingston Enterprise that stated 2 weeks earlier. Now, this is obviously, he disappears on the 7th. This article's on the 28th. So they're saying on about the 14th, a week after Aaron disappears, searchers are in the field, and they found a pair of boots and a camelback. And both of them were identified as belonging to Aaron. Now, one search and rescue worker makes a statement in the article that barefoot, you're not going to go and travel far. So we searched a quarter mile radius and we found nothing. So this was next to a creek. Search and rescue finds his 2 boots and a camelback. Now there's 2 feet of snow on the ground. You're the search and rescue people. You know Aaron's not going far. If he went anywhere. So they brought 20 different canine teams into that area to see if they could pick up a scent. They found nothing. They brought in 7 equestrian teams. They found nothing. They looked for tracks leaving the area. They found nothing. 50 ground searchers found nothing. Now, they brought in a helicopter with forward-looking infrared, and they found nothing, meaning that they were looking for something emitting heat on the ground. And if you die one day, you're going to emit heat for a couple days. The National Guard flew a series of sorties. They found nothing. 15 days after the search started, they found nothing, and it was terminated. Now, 9 months later, the case takes an unusual turn, to say the least. 2 men were working on repairing a fence in Sweetgrass County. One man was repairing the fence, and his dad was just kind of walking around, keeping him company, visiting. Well, his dad finds a bow, a backpack, and an orange vest. And his dad said he's looking at this stuff, and he's thinking he's going to find a body because it must have been a bear that killed someone right here. And they looked around. They didn't find anything other than just this equipment. Well, the men called the sheriff, and it wasn't before long that the sheriff ID'd the property as Aaron's. Now, here's where it's almost beyond understanding. The location where the vest and the backpack was found was 15 cross-country air miles in deep snow from point to point from where Aaron's boots were found. Now, the items were found 2 miles from a ranch house. They searched the area intensively where they found this backpack, and they found nothing.
So there's no way he walked 15 miles with no boots on.
Well, let me get you to the part where they interview the lieutenant. So remember what the SAR worker said. He said, well, Aaron couldn't travel far from the point they found the boots. That's the reason they just...
I'll tell you what, Dave, I have to interrupt you. I'm sorry. The music is telling us we need to take a break. But this story is really getting good here. The story of Aaron Hedges, 38 years old, disappears in the crazy mountains. We'll be right back with more of this right after this on Coast to Coast AM.